Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show. You just saw him right there on the screen, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm at AH Malcolm on the Twitters. He controls the cameras too. I mean he's in charge of everything. You guys don't know this. He's in charge of everything. Secretly, the man behind everything, so we can blame Andrew Malcolm for everything that's going on, right? Is that right?
Everything today is a conspiracy. You're right.
It's a Malcolm conspiracy. All right. Well, and we're back on a normal day, too, which is nice. And just past the weekend, we got all sorts of things to discuss. Let's start off with the dog that didn't bark. I was kind of half expecting a military strike on Iran over the weekend. Instead, today, Axios is reporting that we're going to have a meeting with Iran on Friday between Stephen Witkoff and their foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi. I suspect that this is box checking. I was just making a note of this in tonight's final word, but I suspect this is box checking because the Saudis came out and said that they weren't going to allow us to use their airspace, which we can kind of get around for offensive operations, but not for defensive operations. And apparently they're a little unhappy about the rush, I guess you could call it, to the military option here. Obviously, the Turks aren't happy about it either. Neither would the Qataris be. So I suspect that this is a little bit of box checking for Trump to just show, hey, I tried to get them to do something significant and they have refused. Were you surprised that nothing happened over the weekend? I really thought they were teeing it up.
Yeah. No, I wasn't surprised because I think what we're going through is sort of a classic Trump setup. And sometimes it ends up in action and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, sometimes it ends up in military action and sometimes it doesn't, but he gets what he wants diplomatically. You remember in the first term, we had a carrier strike group, or maybe that's right, it was two carrier strike groups go up near North Korea when Kim Jong-un. When Kim Jong-un was talking about fire and brimstone, and Trump promised the end of the world and so on. And nothing happened militarily, although I guess we did have a SEAL raid that didn't work out quite right. But it did prompt Kim to come to the negotiating table twice. That's two summits with an American president from North Korea when three presidents before couldn't work anything out. Then, was it maybe 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, there was a lot of talk about military action, and Trump was planning, was considering all the options and moving military forces. He's bringing a carrier strike group from the Pacific and so on. And then we heard that the mullahs had all gone underground and they prepared their defense systems and so on. I read an interesting analysis by a British writer that said that was a head fake, but now Trump and the intelligence agencies knew everything that the Iranians would do if there was a real strike coming, that it was a setup to read what their preparations would be. So I don't know if there's anything really coming. You're right about the boxes. Absolutely. He's got to look like he's working this out diplomatically, although nothing is going to come from it. And I don't think anything's going to come out of the peace effort in Ukraine either, for that matter. But
There was some potential news on that today. Apparently, India and the U.S. agreed on a trade agreement, and India is, at least according to Trump, is going to cut off Russian oil purchases, which may squeeze Russia enough to force them into.
Well, hopefully it will squeeze them, but I don't see Putin. He's never been susceptible to a squeeze. So I don't see it ending anything. It may make it harder for him, but He's not losing any relatives in the fighting, and he's not losing anything economically himself. So, you know, the only thing he's got, the only thing he's got to lose is not winning in Ukraine or looking like he won something. And then his friends in the Kremlin may have imposed term limits as they have in the past. But yeah, you'll notice in the announcement, India did not say anything about Russian oil.
I noticed that, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So that would be good. That's huge because they're buying a large quantity of oil at a deep discount.
1.3 million barrels a day, which is a lot. Yeah. You know, that's about a billion and a half, billion, depending on the discount, billion and a half of dollars, not rubles, but dollars of revenue to Putin a month. And he's already, I mean, his income has declined 22% from January 2025. So, I mean, yeah, it's going to hurt if India actually does do that.
Russia, the economy, economically, they've got inflation going on. The economy is suffering. He hasn't imposed conscription because that would, I think, set things off.
Yep.
Things. So, yeah, there's a real economic trouble. I saw another analysis that I'd have to pull up to cite, but oh, I know, it was the president of Finland. He was on YouTube. And he was listing all the things that have happened. They're now losing 30 to 35,000 men a month, Russia is, in the fighting. That's now coming up on 2 million casualties in less than 4 years. So
this is worse than Afghanistan for them, I think. I mean, militarily speaking, I think it's worse than Afghanistan.
Yeah, they didn't lose anywhere near that amount. And they learned their lesson and pulled out in 10 years, took us 20. So,
Well, there was that too, although we weren't sustaining Russia-type losses in Afghanistan either. We had actually pretty well eliminated that by the time we started thinking about pulling out. So,
And we had mission creep. Russia wasn't trying to build a nation state. We were. And obviously
they were building a vassal. They were building a vassal state and doing a pretty good job of it too, up until the last couple of years. But
Alexander the Great figured that out.
Yeah. And so did the British eventually.
Yeah. And the Sikhs tried to take them over. It was, it doesn't work in Beijing, or it's not a country. It's what basically it is. It's a whole bunch of tribes.
It's basically a tribal area. It is not a country. And basically this is the Pashtuns against practically everybody else. And the Pashtuns are about 40 to 45% of the population there. So the Pashtuns tend to win, especially since the other tribes, except with the exception of the time that the Northern Alliance was there, the rest of the tribes don't get along with each other either. So the Pashtuns end up, winning by the traditional method of, you know, divide and conquer. But just to get back to Iran, I mean, because it borders on Iran too. I think that when we're talking about Iran, I think we're talking about, there's a whole series of options here, most of which are not going to produce a really great outcome. And I think the idea here is that they're going to try to put enough pressure on so that the Iranian people do it themselves, because we can't do it militarily. All you have to do is take a look at a map and you know that we can't do anything in Iran militarily either. Tehran's on the north end of the country, so you can't get there, you know, with a bunch of men. So you have to get the Iranians to rise up. But, you know, the other thing too, and I think that this is something that people kind of miss, is that even if they overthrow the mullahs and even if they don't bring back the Shah, what's likely to follow the mullahs is not likely to look like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson sat down and wrote the Constitution. I mean, it's just not that kind of culture. I mean, it's an ancient culture. It's a rich culture, but it's not a culture that lends itself to secular democratic republics.
Right.
We're going to have to scale our expectations, even best case scenarios. You're going to wind up with something that looks
And it could Islamic. Be messy. And it could yeah, be I mean, messy.
Somebody was like, suggesting to me today that the best option is a Zoroastrian takeover of Iran. But Zoroastrianism isn't really a governing philosophy in the way that Islam is. It's a religious thing. Zoroastrianism is probably somewhat distantly related, or at least similar to Hinduism, and that's not really a governing philosophy either. It's just the religious context in which this takes place. Now, the Hindus have a functioning democracy. Actually, it's a democratic republic. It's not as secular as we'd like it to be at times, especially now. But it's actually a functioning democracy, and they have their issues. But, you know, theocracy and terrorism, outwardly directed terrorism anyway, isn't one of them. And so, we'll have to scale our expectations there.
Yeah, and we don't want to create another lawless state like Libya.
Like Libya or even Iraq for the first several years, you know. Iraq was a mess too.
When the West, the U.S., goes in over nuclear weapons to change things, it doesn't work out too well. We promised Britain, France, and Russia promised Ukraine if they turned over their Soviet-era nukes, which are now somewhere in Russia, that we would guarantee their stability. And, we can see now that Putin doesn't keep any promises. And the West is the West, which guaranteed Ukrainian sovereignty, isn't prepared to do anything about it except help arm a proxy war.
Yeah.
In Libya, 2001, we told Gaddafi, if you turn over your nukes, you're okay. And then 2011, Europe and then Obama joined them, went in and threw him out. Mob found him in a culvert and killed him. So if you're North Korea, even Pakistan and Iran, you're not putting much validity in not having nuclear weapons. I mean, that's just the fact. You can have another agreement like Obama did, and they can say, we'll do this, we'll do that. And then they stop the monitoring, and it just drags on and on and on. But it's inevitable. And then, of course, there's the ballistic missiles. So Israel has the biggest stake in this. And they've shown they're not shy. They're not shy about taking action. And we appreciate it.
I want to turn our attention to a couple of media stories. I know they're related to each other. So, and I do want to get to your column, your latest column over at Red State. But I want to talk about a couple of things that have been going on in the media. One is that the New York Times featured a Gaza doctor, right, who was writing essays in the op-ed section about how awful Israel was and how the Israelis were targeting the healthcare system, civilian healthcare infrastructure. And they just identified him as a doctor in Gaza, right? I think they identified him as a hospital administrator and physician, right? Well, it turns out he's got another job. He kind of moonlights as a Hamas colonel, which was...
Isn't that something?
Which wasn't really a secret either. I mean...
Yeah. You know, I don't think this would happen. Barry Weiss had her job diversifying the people appearing on the New York Times op-ed page. But what a colossal something.
Yeah, I'm not even surprised. They were looking for people who were going to go after Israel and go after the Jews. I mean, that's just what it was. And... Yeah. I don't think it's news to anybody who actually reads the New York Times these days to understand that the gray lady is a big fat whore. And I'm sorry, but that's, it's a crude way to put it, but it is what it is. You know, she basically sold her bed to Hamas for propaganda. And that is
not the first time.
Not the first time. No, I mean, I understand why you offer it to Vladimir Putin. This is before the war in Ukraine, where Vladimir Putin would occasionally write essays for the New York Times. You know, Javad Zarif, who used to be the foreign minister, I think, of Iran, and now it's Abbas Araghchi. I'm not sure what Javad Zarif is doing these days. Which, you know, at the time that government was cheering, you know, death to America, but the New York Times was willing to give him an essay. And I was okay with that right up until the time that everybody freaked out because Tom Cotton wrote about the Insurrection Act.
Yeah, wasn't that a piece of work? Oh, my God.
At that point, if you're gonna have that type of value discernment, then I think included in that value discernment is you don't offer your space to terrorists and to leaders of countries that are looking to destroy the United States.
Yeah.
Putin or...
If you're honest.
Yeah, if you're honest, yeah.
And you know, one of the little noticed facts about the Cotton episode was in my day when I was there for 26 years, but I left in the early 90s, it was church and state. Okay. Editorial page was on the 10th floor in Times Square. They've moved now, the news part was on the third floor. Mm-hmm. And they didn't meet. Now, the editorial department had really good off-the-record lunches on Thursdays with newsmakers. I mean, important people, you know, Henry Kissinger and all those people. They would have them in. They'd bring in deli sandwiches and be off the record for an hour and a half or 2 hours. I found those fascinating. I had to get special permission to attend those from the third floor. What happened in the Cotton episode was Dean Baquet, the executive editor, took care of it, and he, you know, sort of chided the editorial department. And the news staff rose up with these specious claims about their safety being endangered because we were publishing an article by a military veteran who was a U.S. senator. I mean, not we, but the New York Times was publishing an article by a U.S. senator. And then the publisher, who, let's say, he's not as strong as his grandfather was, who was the publisher when I was there, he caved, and Barry Weiss left. They fired James Bennett, who is the senator's brother from Colorado, and a big, big shakeup. Barry Weiss had been hired 3 years before to diversify the contributors, which is exactly what she did. Now, she was exiled to invent the free press, get $200 million for selling it to CBS, and now she's in charge of news at CBS. So things turned out well for her, but for the news consumers, it didn't turn out well. And you're right, it's very disappointing what the Times has done.
Well, I mean, it just is, it's a disgrace. It's a disgrace to not disclose to your readers that what you are publishing is in fact propaganda for a terrorist network, because that's exactly what it was. And it's not like they couldn't have figured it out either. I'm sure that everybody over there at the Gray Lady is doing their best. I am shocked to find out that somebody who was offered to us by the Gaza Ministry of Health turned out to be a Hamas colonel.
The Ministry of Health. The Ministry of Health, which is Hamas.
It's Hamas. But
they're still using the figures of casualties. Totally made up.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's nonsense. The whole thing is nonsense. And I read that this morning, and I was just really disgusted. I was disgusted by it and frankly not at all surprised. And I know that, you know, we say a lot about the New York Times and the Washington Post and stuff like that, And criticism's criticism. It can apply in lots of different directions. But honestly, this is basically, in my mind, giving aid and comfort to the enemy, because Hamas murdered dozens of Americans in that October 7th massacre. They have, you know, they and other Iranian terror affiliates have been killing Americans for decades. And yep. And it's one thing if you say, well, we're going to go ahead and put a Hamas colonel on our editorial page, and here's the reason why we think it's important to get this perspective. That's fine. I think I'd still disagree with that, but at least it would be honest. This isn't honest at all. They passed this guy off as some sort of, you know, unaffiliated physician who was only concerned about the care of his patients. And this is a guy who's a high ranking. He's one step below a general in Hamas. I mean, it's not like he's just some, you know, he was just some enlisted, you know, whatever you would, you know, whatever the, it's not really a military organization anyway, it's a terrorist organization. But this guy was high up. He's a high ranking member of that terrorist organization. And the New York Times is covering for him. So that was one thing. The other thing was, and this is more amusing, Scott Jennings at CNN. Now, this reminds me of the Tom Cotton episode, right? Because apparently CNN's president or chief or whatever his title is over there decided to hold an all-hands meeting to discuss the, you know, to discuss whatever is on their minds, right? This was sort of like an open gripe session, right? I've been in those, you know, just tell us whatever's on your mind. Let us know what are your big concerns. Now, this is a channel whose movie studio owner is looking to dump them on something, right? They're trying to get rid of the cable channels. Their viewership is going into the toilet. Their credibility is worse. And what's the biggest issue on their mind, according to the Daily Beast and Status? It's Scott Jennings. And Scott Jennings using the term illegal alien. Yeah. Let's make this stuff up.
Isn't that something?
It's the same stupid struggle session 6 years ago at the Times, right?
Yeah. It's pathetic. He is a breath of well-spoken, erudite, fresh air. I have to say that, watching him. And they may regret having hired him.
Hired him. They gave him a bigger contract about a few months back. I think it was like over the summer. They need to hold on to him. He's the only thing interesting they've got.
Yeah, he is for us, but he creates problems because he points out the hypocrisy of the woke people still there. It's entertaining. You're right. That's about the only reason to watch, I think.
Well, and here's the thing. Their biggest issue is that they're losing viewers. This guy actually attracts viewers, and they want to get rid of him because they can't beat him in a debate, right?
That's a good way to put it. One of those, I guess we'll get to it, but in yesterday's, in the Sunday column on Red State of Mind, I had one of those paragraphs that, it's just like the Scott Jennings thing you're talking about. He attracts viewers and they want to get rid of him. And I had a paragraph and said, try to wrap your head around this. We have protesters legally protesting ICE's legal arrests of people who are illegally here and have committed crimes. I mean, how could you imagine anything more ridiculous than Americans? Many of them are being paid, I know that, but protesting getting rid of criminals from another country. It just blows your mind.
Yeah, and that's, by the way, how Joe Biden turned immigration from treasured history to deadly. It's just right off the screen here. I've been spending today enjoying, from treasured history to deadly. Yeah. A lengthy column. You guys should read it, by the way. It's a great VIP column from Andrew. You know what's interesting about this, about what's going on there? First off, it seemed to have come off the front pages a little bit over the last few days, ever since Tom Homan went there. You and I talked about this briefly, about Tom, well, maybe not even briefly. We talked about it last week, last week's podcast, about it being really a brilliant stroke by Trump sending Homan there and changing, you know, getting a little room to change the narrative and try to dial down the temperatures, which I think has been somewhat successful.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's a no-nonsense guy. And he's one that Democrats have a hard time criticizing because he did a great job deporting thousands of people, over a million in the first 36 months of Obama's first term. And Obama gave him a special presidential award for his work. So he's a good guy in this job. He's no-nonsense. He's aware of the problems and the dangers and the landmines. And Trump was smart to send him there. You know, and Trump was smart to try to dial down the temperature because he was losing that. And Walz knew he was losing his narrative. One of the things that's striking about these things these days, why officials do things, is they're not doing their official actions so much, it seems to me, because they're the right thing to do. They're doing it because it looks good, or they're stopping doing it because it looks bad. You know, the merits of the actions get lost in the appearance. And of course, it's all because of television. It seems like the priorities are, how can we make this look better? How can we get a more positive narrative? And in this case, in dialing down the temperature in Minnesota, is especially in January, should be helpful.
Well, I think it will be, although there's still a lot of, the latest thing on this is that the anti-ICE protesters are now setting up, you know, the autonomous zones, which they are patrolling by checking IDs for people to go in and out. I mean, you really can't make this stuff up. And then Will Stancil, who's a lefty, right, who's I got to pull this up because this was actually pretty amusing. Give me just a second. I'm going to read this off because Will Stancil, who's kind of a lefty, earlier today on Blue Sky. You know he's lefty because he's on Blue Sky, right? Yeah, nobody else is on Blue Sky, right? He's quote tweeting, or whatever you call it on Blue Sky, somebody who is saying that it's too early to do discourse, but this guy should be cut off from all left-oriented spaces online and in real life. He's a danger to everyone around him. Apparently talking about Stancil, right? And Will Stancil says it's head-spinning. Somehow after 22 days of spending 5+ hours a day patrolling for ICE, the Antifa types have decided that not only should I not be allowed to do that, but I am, quote, a danger to everyone around me, end quote, and should be universally excluded from left spaces. Insanity. My crime? Talking to mainstream press about what was happening, posting a handful of videos of public spaces, edited to ensure that no one else is identified, stating my disapproval of agitators lighting fires in my neighborhood and getting punched in the head for the trouble. Maybe you can start to figure this out, Will.
Yeah.
This is the beginning of enlightenment. And one of the person who sent this around on Twitter is a guy named Coddled Affluent Professional, who has he has a Substack and he's got a pretty decent number of followers. And this is a great comment by him. Solzhenitsyn had these scenes where members of the party faithful would get deposited off the prison train at the gulag to begin their years of hard labor, incredulent and insistent that some mistake had been made and that the system wasn't doing what it was designed for. It's sad. It's sad if our educational system has failed in imparting the lessons of 20th century to the degree like people like Stancil aren't able to enjoy the irony that these dumbed down little episodes have deep historical echoes. And yes, I mean, wasn't even the Soviets that started this. You can go back to Robespierre. How did Robespierre end up dying? He got Robespierre'd.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh my gosh. Oh gosh.
It's very entertaining.
And that's not even the joke of the day. We're coming to the joke of the day here in just a moment. I've actually got two now. One, which is apparently a true story. I am hesitant because I saw it on the internet.
Well, everything, you know, I mean, if Abraham Lincoln believed the stories on the internet, maybe you can.
This is apparently a true story from France. A Toulouse hospital was evacuated after a 24-year-old patient was discovered with a 20-centimeter World War I artillery shell lodged in his rectum. Emergency surgery successfully removed the shell while bomb disposal experts secured the device and later declared it safe. Staff and patients were evacuated, a security perimeter was set up. An investigator said the patient had inserted the object himself, causing extreme discomfort. Yeah, you think?
No, really. Yeah.
That's sort of like the Will Stansel moment for this guy.
That's going to be a meme. The Will Stansel moment.
The Will Stansel moment. Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, go over and read Andrew's great column, How Joe Biden Turned Immigration from Treasured History to Deadly. That is one of his two new VIP entries. The other one is, why don't Dems ever fix their screw-ups instead of trying to hide them? Well, I think that that's true, but I think that there are some Republicans probably who could be included in that. But hey, it's just politics. Maybe it's just human nature. It's the difference is that the media won't let Republicans get away with it. And that's really the difference.
All right.
We've got one joke of the day. I got it from jokesoftheday.net. And where I like to go, it's a lot of fun. So here you go, Andrew. See if I can make you laugh.
Okay. All right.
All right. You prepared for this one? It's even clean.
I'll try.
It's a lot cleaner than the Will. Wow, it's a lot cleaner than the Will Stansel moment I just got done explaining. All right. Two guys are driving down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan when they come up to a red light. The guy driving slams on the gas pedal and they go zooming past the red light. His friend looks at him and says, "Hey, you just went through a red light." He says, "Nah, don't worry about it. My brother does this all the time." So they keep driving. They come to another red light. And sure enough, the guy slams the pedal. They go screaming through it. Now his passenger's really starting to get nervous. He says, "Hey, man, you just went through another red light. What are you doing?" He says, "Don't worry about it. My brother does this all the time." They come up to a third red light. And sure enough, the guy slams it. Now the guy's like, "You know, you need to let me out. This is not safe." He says, "Don't worry about it. My brother does this all the time." And the passenger starts feeling relieved because he sees that the next light is green. And the guy comes up to it, slams the brakes on, comes to a screeching halt right in front of the green light. And the passenger goes, "What the hell are you doing?" He says, "Well, I had to stop because my brother might be coming."
Okay. All right.
That was clean.
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah, it took a minute or a second, but it was funny. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll give you that one, Ed.
All right. Little jokes of the day. Now go check it out. It's a lot of fun. Pay me by the. This is not a sponsor bit. I just when I'm looking for a funny joke, that's where I go. And if you guys have other suggestions, I'm happy to hear them. But they're pretty reliable about giving you a couple, at least one or two that are funny each day. So enjoy it. And I don't think they make a lot of money anyway. So whatever we can do to help them out, we probably should. Andrew Malcolm, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com. We'll talk again next week, sir.
We will. And thank you, everybody. And thank you, Ed, for having me on again.
Well, it's better than what you normally get on Groundhog Day, which is
today. Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that.
We're gonna look at our shadow and see if we get six more weeks of Tim Walz. But all right, there's another joke of the day.
That's a good one. That's a good one. You got two this week.
We got two in there. All right. We'll talk next week. Thanks, man.
Okay. Take care.